So this is Jan Melling, and I'm Caroline Lewis from the Oral History Group at Arundel Museum. The date is the 6th of July 2022, and the time is 2 p.m, and the interview is located in the office of St Nicholas Church. We're interviewing Father David Twinley and Fiona Maxwell. Twinley, T-W-I-N-L-E-Y, Maxwell, M-A-X-W-E-L-L, for the Life During the Pandemic project.
Can I just start and ask you, at the beginning of the pandemic, what prompted you to start this community hub?
It was around the time the news was breaking of the pandemic in Italy, and we could see that it was having a devastating effect on communities. I think at that stage there had been one case locally in Brighton, or perhaps no cases in the UK. But it seemed clear to me that at some stage it would come this way. And if it did, then we needed to have something in place, ready to help people with basic needs, such as shopping and fetching medication. So I think a couple of weeks or so before lockdown came, just on a Sunday morning, I'd asked for volunteers in the church to, at that stage, really, I was thinking primarily of the church family, of the congregation here. And a number of people said, oh, yes, I'm available to help if needs be. And then with Fiona here, right, we spoke about how the back office might work. I mean, how do we pay for what we need? How do we communicate? And so we set up a really simple system here in the office whereby Fiona would contact and would receive requests and then contact our volunteers, and that payments would be done either online or over the phone by sort of card. And we would receive payments from the people who had shopping bought for them, and that we would pass those payments on to the people who had paid for it. That seemed to be the easiest way to do it. So we had that in place, but very quickly, when COVID arrived on these shores, you know, it seemed no time at all that we were in that lockdown. And we wanted to do more. And the opportunity came to get the message out there via social media. And in no time at all, we had dozens and dozens of volunteers from across the town. And at the same time, requests started coming in for help, and I think principally because, obviously, being the church and being the established church, in those times people naturally sort of, you know, we'll do a search online, who can we go to for help? And so I was getting phone calls from particularly concerned relatives from around the country saying, you know, my mum and dad are in Arundel. They say they're okay, but I'm not sure. How can we help them? We've tried booking slots for delivery. And it was lovely to be able to say to them, don't worry, we have a system already in place. At that stage, untested, but it was in place in theory. And that's sort of where it all started. And very quickly, I think because we had it in place, there wasn't a sense of having to reinvent something very quickly. We'd had a couple of weeks thinking about it. And so, to my mind, Fiona was at the sharp end, it ran very smoothly from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, it was quite a simple formula, really. You know, we had the volunteers there, and that was aided by Mark Phillips on the Arundel Facebook site. And he was very good. He sort of collated them all and sorted them all out for us as well.
How many volunteers did you have?
Off the top of my head now, I think we were about 180, were we?
Something
I would need to look it up again. But around that number. And it really, you know, it was quite simple, just putting one person's need in touch with somebody else who'd offered a skill set and just seeing if they matched. One particular lady, I think, had dietary requirements, and it didn't matter which of her relatives shopped for her. They always bought her what they wanted to buy her rather than what her diet required. And she was so relieved that we married her up, I think, with a nurse who was going to shop for her, who actually got her what she wanted and kept her health sort of prime, really.
Yeah. So that's one of the needs. What other needs were there?
Oh, we were asked for all sorts, from shopping, prescriptions, lifts to the hospital for appointments, dental prescriptions. What else did we have?
Well, we then set up a little bit after that, a sort of phone buddy system.
Yeah.
So we drew up lists of people that we thought were either living on their own as a sort of first priority or vulnerable. And we then shared out names and numbers with a group of people. At that stage, it was pretty much all from the church. So these are people that we knew and often had DBS checks and that kind of thing. And there was a lot of phone calls were going on. And it was, I remember one gentleman, I can't remember how I got his number, but I phoned him. I think somebody tipped me off that there was someone who was particularly vulnerable, and I phoned him. And the moment he realised that someone was concerned for him, he was just in floods of tears. He'd seen nobody, he'd spoken to nobody, and all of a sudden there was someone who cared enough to give him a call. I can't remember who gave me his name and number, but I'm very grateful. And, you know, over the next year or so, I phoned him from time to time and, you know, we'd have some wonderful conversations on the phone. And that was a really good thing to be able to do.
I think the gentleman concerned was actually flagged up by a local restaurant that he used to frequent before lockdown.
Yes, you're right.
And they were concerned for him. So it sort of went full circle.
I think he had his lunch there every day or something. Yes. And they yeah. just wondered what was happening.
Mm.
And, but that was terribly emotional to hear his tears of relief that just someone cared enough to give him a call.
But he stayed in touch all the way through, sort of, you know, probably every 10 days he rang us, really, just to have a chat and say thank you, which was really, you know, there's, you know, a few people that did that, and it's quite humbling, really.
How many people did you support then over that first period of time?
It's a few hundred, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it
was, I will look it up for you and give you the correct figure.
In my head, it was around sort of 300 and
yes,
something.
Yes, you're exactly right.
But sort of 350 people, something like that. And all very much from the local area, from Arundel. We were getting, early days, we were getting calls from outside Arundel, from the villages roundabout. And we decided it would be difficult to spread our wings that far. So we started, we communicated with other, particularly local churches. We would say, we've had a call from so-and-so in your area. Could you get in touch? They need help. And in every case it was, yes, no problem. We'll do that. So we were getting calls from quite a wide
area. We were sort
of
out at Burpham, Lyminster, Ford, Fontwell, Slindon, etc. And I think, because they knew we were up and running, the calls came here. But I think once they realised that their own parishes were putting something in place, it kind of alleviated things a little bit. But, you know, if there was an emergency, we still did
it,
really.
Yes, of course.
It wasn't a problem. But I think also the other extension of that was there were people who were isolating with COVID who weren't having hot meals at all. And so we had a little circle of people that would drop a meal into people. And I think some of them went on doing it for quite a long time on a weekly basis. So it was rather nice.
And your volunteers, what type of people were they? What sort of backgrounds, ages?
Well, fortunately for us, there was an awful lot of people who were, you know, unable to work because of COVID, were having to stay at home. And so they were all quite capable people. But then a lot of the people who were saying they would like to be a phone buddy were more elderly or housebound anyway. And so they felt they were sort of paying back and doing something. And they were very good at it, actually. They could, you know, once we'd spoken to them and chatted with them and found out what they'd done in life, it got very easy to marry them up with people to chat with. So, but there was, you know, we had everything. A lot of men that were working from home, businessmen, who were more than happy to, you know, go out there and run vaccinations, you know, people to vaccinations latterly, or, you know, there was endless, wasn't there? Endless, a lot of nurses, teachers, just mums at home.
Yeah. Did you set any sort of protocols for the volunteers, you know, things, do's and don'ts, or any sort of advice?
I think when they started driving people in the cars, we had a basic guideline to it. But both the driver and the person accepting the help knew that, A, it was a volunteer, and, B, they were accepting this as a volunteer.
And this is probably before lateral flow tests were widely available.
Yeah.
And as far as general volunteers, we just followed the mm-hmm. sort of national guidelines of, you know, dropping off on the door,
yeah.
and then walking away, not standing at the door, mm-hmm. chatting, keeping distance,
mm-hmm.
Wearing masks, all the mm-hmm. things that were in place yeah. throughout the country.
And I think with the car journeys as well, with the permission of the person that wanted the help, the volunteer would ring them and speak with them, and they set their own guidelines. So they made their arrangements, you know, what they were both happy and not happy with. So,
mm-hmm. And as a coordinator, what would be your typical day at the office during lockdown?
Well, I did work from here. Where I live, the internet was very, very poor, and I would have been, you know, with a child home educating, it would have been absolutely impossible for me to receive anything at home. So I did come in. A typical day would be, by the time I got here, I came in a bit earlier. By the time I got here, there would be a good 4 or 5 messages on the answer machine here of people requesting things that day. And then it just went, some days it just went fairly constantly, didn't it? The phone rang, or I just had a list that, you know, I was hoping by sort of maybe 3 o'clock I would be able to do something about. Finding the volunteers as well was a numbers game. You know, you'd have to maybe sometimes ring 7 or 8 people because they were doing something else, you know, helping somebody else. So it was just a numbers game. After a while, when we asked somebody to help somebody, we asked if they would stay with them, you know, and touch base with them periodically, so they knew to call each other. So come the second lockdown, a lot of that help was still in place. So rather than the people having to ring and say, well, I need a prescription this week, next week, they could just get hold of their old volunteer. I know a couple of people are still shopping for each other to this day, so which is nice.
So with the vaccinations, when they were introduced, how did you deal with them?
At first, I must admit, we were expecting the vaccinations to be done locally.
Yeah.
So, I'd offered the use of the church to the local surgery, but it became clear after a little while that it was not going to be done at a sort of very local level. So we had to think, well, how do we get people there? Because, you know, a lot of people don't drive, and public transport was something they didn't want to do. So we turned to our volunteers again and said, okay, who's willing to give lifts to the vaccination centres, which the main one we used was the one at Bognor, but people to Midhurst and...
I think we had, yes, Midhurst, Brighton on occasion, yep. Portsmouth, Chichester... but the majority were Bognor.
So with the second lockdown, did you feel it was different?
Yes. A, people were fed up. and so the conversations were different. Different in that... You know, people were a little bit more resilient in that if they could do things themselves, they would. You know, we have little elderly ladies in Arundel that we know quite well who were insistent on going to the co-op absolutely every day and, you know, buying their shopping. And, you know, I think some people had had enough and just wanted to live a little. But, yes, I think a lot of the calls here were different in that We had much longer conversations with people. People were just wanting to chat, to sort of vent their frustrations, really. So that was different.
Did you see a different type of client, in the sense that were they younger because they had caught COVID and were in situations?
I would say the first time round we saw more younger people with health complications. But the second sort of time round, it was really more the elderly people that were still, you know, needing the same sort of attention, but were feeling more lonely, really.
And I understand that there were many friendships formed, you know, doing the buddy phone calls and the work that the volunteers did. Could you share some stories with us, if you know any, about those friendships?
Yes, I think, you know, we've got one particular lady who was one of my people that rang in every week to say thank you. It was an absolute joy. But, I mean, very elderly. And she was partnered up with someone and her family that are really good friends to this day. And I think, you know, early on when you weren't to mix and you could see somebody, you know, outside, the lady used to bring her children into the garden to see her. She said her birthday was made when they arrived in the garden with a cake for her. And it was all, you know, none of it was taken for granted. They, you know, they took her, taken her off on outings since with the family. And the lady does have a family, but, you know, this was just a sort of an extra lifeline. They've stayed friends. A person who was in this morning talking to us, she's still shopping for the same lady that she shopped with from the beginning of COVID. You know, I wouldn't even like to think how many shops they've done, you know. I'm just trying to think, really. But, you know, they're really, you know, oh, another example is a friend of mine, actually, who phone buddied a lady in Arundel, an elderly lady, and they now go out, I think every Monday they meet and go out for a coffee. And as soon as lockdown was over, they have started doing that. And they're kind of friends to this day from it. Which is lovely, but there are, you know, heaps of people have stayed friends, which is lovely.
To backtrack slightly, with shopping, the volunteers work really hard, and I can think of examples where, you know, someone was out shopping for, you know, sometimes more than one person, and of course they're having to sort of shop for a week's worth. So, you know, this person may have spent 4 hours in the supermarket filling several trolleys worth of, you know, he did, didn't he? Well, I mean, you know who I'm talking about.
Particular gentleman said he saw the shop staff arrive and they finished their shift and left before he'd finished shopping.
That was astonishing. It really is.
And that was a weekly thing.
That was a weekly thing for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And where did they shop? Was it just local?
We tried to say to people that if we had a volunteer who was kind enough to shop for them, unless there were real dietary requirements, that, you know, they just had to take what was on offer.
But sometimes people would phone up asking for help with shopping, but they insisted it had to come from a particular supermarket. And we kind of knocked that one on the head and said, well, no, it will come from where it comes from.
You know, we sort of learnt where our volunteers shopped. You know, one particular person always went to Tesco, somebody else always went to Morris, and, you know, somebody was just the co-op. So we kind of knew, and we could, you know, try and give them to the right person. But it was fun, really, trying to work it out, wasn't it? Yeah.
And this was obviously an emotional time for everyone. So how did it impact both of you individually with this situation?
From my point of view, it was a strange time. I think, first of all, was the devastating news that we had to close the door of the church, which I thought was the wrong decision then, and I still think was the wrong decision. Maybe, you know, services wouldn't have been appropriate, but I think keeping the building open for people to come into, I think would have helped with mental health issues and mm-hmm. some issues people have had. So that was very difficult for me to take. But at the same time, we did turn to online worship, and although that had its limitations, it worked at the time. I think we did very well with it. So there were challenges. On the other side, I could really see that we'd got ahead of the game and we were doing some really good work with our you know, many, many volunteers. Mm-hmm. And there was a good feeling in that. And it was nice to be able to feel that, for me personally, that I was sort of doing my bit. And although, for example, we were not to go out except for, you know, cases of work where you had to, I was still able, for example, to visit our school, because a church school remained open to children from key workers. So I would get to the school most weeks and, you know, I would say hello to them in the playground, outside. So there was this frustration and also this, I guess, almost excitement of being able to do something. Also, I have to say, for me personally, although we were very busy, the ordinary distraction stopped. My life is often dominated by meetings. Suddenly, there were no meetings. I had time to think, time to be. I had time to be with my family, which, you know, having been ordained for over 20 years now, I rarely see my family. Suddenly, that first spring, you know, we were having lunch together in the garden, and that was just so there was good sides, but then there was the sad side. We had a parishioner and a much loved member of the congregation here who contracted COVID, went into intensive care, and of course, normally I go to hospital, I go to the intensive care unit. I couldn't. And neither could his wife. And people were asking how he was doing. And it was, you know, there was rarely any good news. Anyway, eventually this person died. Kind of.
It was a long haul.
June 2020, something like that, June 7th. I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we had this very strange funeral with just a handful of people inside the church.
Which was odd because he was a very sociable person, oh, yes. Wasn't he?
But it was a nice funeral. And then, you remember those times, we weren't seeing many people. We saw odd people here and there, but we weren't seeing many people. But I'd let people know that when we left, the funeral left, the cortege would take a particular route. And then if people happened to be taking their daily exercise at that time, it would be a way of giving their respects. And blow me, we came out of the church drive and all the way along the road were, I don't know, there was probably 100 people, I would have thought, all carefully spaced out.
Yeah.
And then as the cortege passed, all clapping. And it was the most amazing time. And the other thing with that funeral was that we came out of church and it really was just close family. About a dozen people, I think, we were allowed. And so we had the son and his wife and maybe child and another little group of the family. And the one person in the middle was the widow, the deceased wife, who was all on her own. And I must admit, I looked at her and I said to her, I know I'm not supposed to do this, but would you like a hug? And she said to me, yes, please. Mm-hmm. And I gave her a big, big hug. Yes, I suppose in theory I was breaking the rules, but sometimes... Mm-hmm. That's important. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, emotionally, it was strange. You kind of had everything from good to desperately sad to frustrating. I've said too much.
No, but I think the worst part of it all is that obviously we can't see into the future. So none of us knew which way all of this was going. And, you know, we sort of joked earlier, oh, no, I wish I'd just get it and then it's out the way. Well, actually, you might get it and out the way. And then, you know, 2 months later, you might have it again. But we didn't know that at the time. And I think the uncertainty was probably the biggest hardship of it. But I think, you know, from what David was saying there as well, the, you know, I used to go home at night and tell my husband and my children about, you know, the people I'd been speaking to that day, because I selfishly met and talked with people that I never would have met in my life. And, you know, I had the most lovely conversations. You know, not sort of sycophantical conversations about the work here or anything, just about, you know, things they've done in their life or the roses they've planted in the garden. And, you know, it was just, it was really uplifting, actually, just to have those conversations with people. And, you know, I think the one thing about lockdown for everybody is that people did simplify a lot. And so, you know, there's the little things in life, you know, as you're saying, you ate with your family. I live up on the top of the Downs, and so we could just walk and walk. And trying to get children and teenagers out of the door is nigh on impossible. So one of them would bake for every walk. And to this day, they remember, oh, was that the chocolate brownie walk? Was that the meringue walk? Was, you know, and so, you know, it was just really silly little things that were the highlights of your day, really. But yes, but I think just the relationships we've made with people, and that's actually been ongoing because that has morphed into our monthly community lunches here. And a lot of those people do attend now, don't they? Which is lovely.
What would you say was the biggest challenges during that pandemic period? Do you say the second lockdown was more challenging than the first lockdown because people couldn't see an end?
For me, work-wise, the first one was, because it was just fast and furious, really. But speaking to people, yes, the second one was mentally more challenging for people.
But otherwise, as far as we were concerned, by the second lockdown, we knew what we were doing.
All in
so
place.
In that sense, it was okay.
Yes.
We were weary.
Yes.
You know, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
But I guess the first lockdown was, although we had organised things well, there was still a certain amount of thinking on our feet and just not knowing what way this was going to go. And how devastating, you know, it was going to be, not just nationally, but very, very locally. I mean, you know, it was scary in that sense. I mean, remember I spoke about Italy at the beginning, and there were the news reports of the, you know, lorry loads of coffins being brought in, and just wondering what was going to happen. You know, were we going to be in that kind of situation? And there was the very real sadness of, you know, losing a number of people. I took another funeral. It was so sad. The lady had died in a care home, and her son was just so devastated. Not so much because of her death, although that was devastating, but because the care home didn't even call him to say that she even had COVID, let alone she wasn't expected to make it. And I don't know the whys and wherefores of that. My guess is they were probably just so busy coping. I wouldn't put any blame onto them necessarily, but for him, this was devastating. And having to be the person pastorally dealing with that, with the sadness, but also the anger, that's always quite challenging.
May I ask how your faith helped you in this difficult time?
For me, enormously, absolutely enormously. Yes, because I think the wonderful thing about the Christian faith is that it's not a faith that denies sadness, suffering, tragedy, pain, but in many ways embraces that and sees that in Christ that suffering is transformed into new life, into joy, into peace, into hope. So that, I think, helps with, you know, never at any stage did I feel remotely sort of despair. That was never my, even though I was worried, you know, I've got family as well. I've got an elderly father with health complications who lives a long way from here. So, you know, I was worried for him. I was worried for my parishioners. But I was never in despair. And of course, also, the Archbishop of Canterbury turned around and said that clergy weren't to go into their churches. And I knew that he didn't have that authority, so I ignored that. And he later admitted he didn't have that authority. He panicked a bit, I think, and I understand that. But so I was in church every day, and you know, I said prayers in church every day. And I was able to record being in church so that people at home could be brought into church, not in my study or my kitchen or something, you know, but brought into their spiritual home. But being in here every day, morning, noon, evening, praying for the people of this parish was a wonderful thing to do. And also being on my own, apart from the angels and archangels, all the company of heaven around me, was very quiet and still and peaceful. And I really rather appreciated that. But yes, it certainly kept me going.
But David kept the community together because, you know, I used to be at home. I used to stay in my bed with my cup of coffee on a Sunday morning in my pyjamas. My husband and I would get the laptop up in front of us. One of the kids may bounce in and watch as well. And we'd listen to David's 10 o'clock service. But what was really nice is that I knew I was sat there with all of my friends, with all of the community watching that. We were all doing the same thing at the same time. And it was really, you know, it just kept everyone together and it kept everyone focused on why they come to church as well.
And after I'd worked out the technology a bit, we started, we'd get people to record different parts. We'd get them to do a reading at home, which they then upload to me on the internet. And then, so what I started doing was I would actually record the service on a Saturday evening. And then I'd be finished around about 7:30. I'd then go home and spend the rest of Saturday evening putting all the other bits and pieces in so that Sunday morning, pretty much our normal time, it was there with a number of people taking part. And everyone was
that was the fun bit, actually. They loved all the different readers.
And including new children. And
yeah.
We did so many things.
But we had really random people that maybe wouldn't have been able to stand up and read in church because of their age or because of a hearing disability or something like that. And they all at some stage gave readings or said the prayers or did something. It was brilliant. Caused quite a stir, didn't it?
It was good.
And then that person, you know, after the show, for lack of better words, would get a sea of you know, comments and emails and things.
Telephone calls, yes.
Father Brian, when he was poorly.
Oh, yeah, bless him.
He loved it because he said, you know, afterwards everybody contacted him and he got to chat with people. And
yeah, it was good.
So that's one positive aspect of pandemic. Is there any other positive aspects that you feel came out of the pandemic? You mentioned about a legacy in the community hub and the...
We were asked to speak at the parish council asked us to speak a little bit about what we've been doing, and we're pleased to do so. And I laid down a challenge to the parish council. Were very pleased about the community spirit that had come out of this, and I laid down a challenge to the community saying, well, how are you going to carry this on? And I sort of walked away afterwards and I thought to myself, yeah, I ought to be asking myself the same question. So we started on the back of that. We started a monthly community lunch. And we started by contacting the various people that we made contact with over the pandemic, and people from here and a wide variety of people. And we now have this community lunch, which every month about 40 or so people come. They have a two-course lunch, a glass of wine, and it's free. That's the important thing. I don't want anyone to feel they can't come because they can't afford it. So it's a lot of people do give a donation, but we don't even ask for donations. That's
if they need a lift, we get them one.
Yeah, we do. We get lifts, and but what that is doing is bringing people together, meeting new people, and it's not just the sort of single, isolated people, lonely people, as we might see it. It could often be a couple. We had a couple recently who I wouldn't have thought of in these terms, but they said, you know, this is wonderful because this is the only time we go out. It's the highlight of our month. And that's really precious. So I'm hoping that will build.
And Parish Church,
it will continue as long as it needs to continue.
Hi Sarah, you okay?
And did you find that there were people who weren't church members that have now become church members because of the pandemic? Because of the role of home.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that one. We are seeing new faces. But I don't think I can attribute it directly to that.
But I understand he stopped doing it.
No, I don't think I could say that. And some churches have experienced that, but I don't think we have.
Yeah. Okay. And lastly, are there any stories about the community how you'd like to share with us that you haven't actually mentioned? Anything you can think about that would be of interest?
Don't think so. I think I've probably said enough.
Okay.